If you want to explore unique perspectives that are rarely expressed in mainstream media, you are listening to the right channel. This is CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Guerrilla Radio, recorded October 16, 2024. Well, as difficult as it is to imagine, after a full year of atrocities visited by Israel upon the heads of civilians of Gaza, the West Bank, and now Lebanon too, greater and more horrible new crimes continue to be devised and executed. Knowing devastation like the erasure of tent encampments at Al-Aqsa Hospital will be repeated, and waiting out the inevitability of by magnitude worse horrors to come, is the dictionary definition of terrorism. State terrorism in this instance, and a terror campaign supported and sustained by Israel's allies in the United States, Europe, and Canada. Dimitri Lascaris is a lawyer, activist, and frontline journalist who's been producing intensive on-the-ground reports from West Asia over the last year and created the new podcast Reason to Resist in the lead-up to the all-out war witnessed there today. He's recently returned from Beirut, where he walked the rubbled streets of that great city to his home base in Greece. Dimitri Lascaris in the first half. And it's accepted now, journalists and activists can expect to be harassed when they arrive home to the countries of the free world. Their phones, cameras, and recording equipment may be seized, and they themselves detained, questioned, intimidated, and even arrested. All this for the crime of not towing the line on stories deemed sensitive to either their own government or one of its allies. And it's not just upon arrival this treatment is meted out, as discovered in Britain by longtime Palestine activist Sarah Wilkinson, whose home was violated by a platoon of balaclava-clad machine gun-toting security men, and she roughly arrested. Dan Kovalix, a lawyer, educator, labor, peace and justice activist, democracy defender, journalist, author, and filmmaker. He's been back and forth to the Donbass region of Russia five times in the last couple of years, talking to the people there and relaying their stories to his fellow Americans. And that has not gone unnoticed. Dan's book titles include Cancel This Book, The Progressive Case Against Cancel Culture, the Plot 2 series on American efforts to undermine the governments and economies of Iran, Venezuela, and Russia, No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interest, and The Case for Palestine, Why It Matters and Why You Should Care. Dan Kovalik bringing it home in the second half. But first, Dimitri Lascaris bearing witness to the wreckage in Beirut. Welcome back to the program, Dimitri.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, it's my pleasure, of course, and congratulations again on Reasons to Resist, your show that you were tied up today talking to one of the luminary talking heads down in the States. I won't mention his name, but if you want to, you can. You feature speakers from all over the region, more importantly, people that we don't see all the time on these shows or on television, especially, at least not on this side of the Atlantic. You were in Beirut yourself last week, and we don't get to see much on-the-ground reporting from there either. What did you see?
Well, up until I arrived there, for 11 straight days, Israel's Air Force had been pummeling Beirut, including particularly the southern suburb of Dahia, from which the Dahia doctrine takes its name, and where Hassan Nasrallah was assassinated, along with hundreds of Israeli or Lebanese civilians a few weeks ago. And then I arrived, Chris, and much to my surprise, there were no bombs dropped on central Beirut or Dahia during the entire time I was there. Now, this morning, Israel resumed its relentless pummeling of Dahia. And throughout the time that I was there, it was heavily bombing other parts of the country, particularly the south and the Bekaa Valley. And it also killed 20 people in a Christian village in the north called Aitu. But for some reason, during those very few days I was there, the city was temporarily spared bombing. And what I noticed, nonetheless, was that a lot of civilian infrastructure had been destroyed since my last visit in August. I visited the site of a number of apartment buildings, medical facilities, that had either been partially or completely destroyed. You know, the very first thing I saw on my way in from the airport was a building I had driven by many times was basically reduced to rubble. And all of the major buildings around it were severely damaged. And then I checked into my hotel. This is Friday night. I then walked to a building that was about a kilometer away from my hotel. It was level to the ground. They still hadn't, pulled out all the survivors. There may not have been any other survivors, but they were still trying to see if anybody had survived. And I also saw something that was new, and that is there were many people in central Beirut sleeping in the streets. Many people, there are always homeless, of course, in Beirut, as Lebanon has been going through a terrible economic crisis. But I hadn't seen anywhere this number of people sleeping in the streets, and many of these people had set up tents. There were a lot of people sleeping in their cars. When I walked through Hamra in central Beirut, I saw, an unfinished commercial tower, office tower, had basically been commandeered by displaced Lebanese. And you could see, this commercial office tower is quite odd to see. All people's laundry was hanging out the windows. They were drying their clothes after washing them. So you could see that a great many people have been displaced. That there was virtually no commercial activity in large parts of the city. Dakhia was almost completely deserted. There's 800,000 people who live there normally. And a lot of devastation. And at this rate, it appears that Israel is absolutely determined to increase the suffering to a considerable degree in the days and weeks ahead.
Well, there's a certain methodology to Israeli action. We saw it in Gaza, how they destroyed the middle class infrastructure, the medical infrastructure, all the civil infrastructure. Seems to be the game plan they're going to unfold for Beirut as well, going right back to those exploding pagers that are mostly carried by doctors, nurses, first responders. What do you think of that as the template of Israel's campaign against its neighbor?
I don't think you could really dispute that Israel is going to try to apply that template, and it's begun to do that. It is clearly trying to destroy the medical system, the healthcare system in Lebanon. It's, striking hospitals directly. It's killing nurses, killing doctors, killing medics. It's been doing this for months, and now it's accelerating the pace of killing. I saw destroyed medical facilities myself, and, Israel didn't even offer a pretext, not even one that was, specious. It offered no pretext, just attacking medical facilities because it can. And it's also very clear that it's trying to render, the city of Beirut, or at least Dakhia, unlivable, as it did in Gaza. The problem that Israel confronts, however, is that Lebanon is a very different target from Gaza. Gaza is under siege. It is much smaller. There is no way, practically speaking, for the military forces in Gaza to be resupplied. They're having to rely on limited supplies of locally produced weapons. Their weapons aren't nearly as sophisticated and numerous as those of the Islamic Resistance in Lebanon. And, they're not under siege. They can be resupplied relatively easily. They're not going to run out of weapons anytime soon as long as they have Iran backing them up. And in addition, the terrain in Lebanon is very different. The south of Lebanon is very hilly and is very rocky, and there are forests all over the place. Gaza is flat, it's sandy, and there are virtually no forests. There's no natural cover for the military forces in Gaza, which is why they have to operate out of infrastructure, out of buildings, because there's no natural cover. There's no mountains they can flee to. So on top of all of that, Hezbollah is a much larger military force than the resistance groups in Gaza. It is much better trained. It has much more combat experience, principally from the Syrian war, which went on for years and was terrible, brutal, bloody. And ultimately, Hezbollah was on the winning side of that war. So Israel's not going to be able to implement the same approach that it took in Gaza. And it's going to take a beating in, if it attempts to do so, and that's already begun. It is taking a beating militarily. And these are not, in my opinion, levels of casualties that Israeli society can sustain. They have a much lower pain threshold than the resistance groups and the peoples who support them in the surrounding countries.
Yeah, I wonder if this sacrifice that Israel is making now isn't just to show the Americans that they're sacrificing and then, you know, impel the American military to stand in for them, as it seems along the road to doing right now with these THAAD launchers and sending the 101 airborne in there as well. When you mentioned, Dmitry, the Dahiya Doctrine and Dahiya, the neighborhood you were mentioning being blasted, that is from those days of the Civil War when Israel had proxies. There's the old saying that generals are always ready to fight the last war, but not the next war. Israel is trying again to get a proxy army set up. People here may not understand that the Lebanese state is different from Hezbollah. Do you want to sort of give us a thumbnail of the difference between those two and this apparent Israeli attempt to once again set up a divide and conquer strategy between the Lebanese state and some of the other ethnicities to set up what they had before, a basic proxy? Mm-hmm.
Well, the Lebanese parliament is a strange beast because of the civil war and the sectarian nature of Lebanese society. So there are, you know, certain number of seats that are allocated for, particular communities like the Shia community, the Sunni community, the Maronite Christian community and so forth. So it's I'm not an expert in the Lebanese electoral system, but my understanding is because of the way the seats are divided up, it's effectively impossible for any party alone to achieve a majority because it couldn't be allocated a majority of the seats, even if there were enough people who voted for the party. Now, within that system, Hezbollah has the largest representation in the Lebanese parliament. It is a political party. Its military wing is actually not called Hezbollah. It's called the Islamic Resistance, and it has allies in the parliament, particularly the Amal political movement. And there are also others in the Lebanese political system who support the resistance, like the – I don't know if they have representation in parliament, but it is a significant political movement, and that's the Syria Social Nationalist Party, SSNP. There are – Christians in the country who are aligned with the resistance, at least for purposes of opposing Israel's genocide and Israel's attacks on Lebanon. My sense, Chris, is that and I don't have polls to prove this, just to be clear, but a substantial majority of the population is supportive of the resistance groups, and they really want to see Israel defeated. They are fed up. I think a lot of people in Lebanon, I've heard repeatedly, this has to end. And the only way for this to end is for Israel to be decisively defeated once and for all, not just by being driven out of South Lebanon, but it actually has to collapse. And if we don't do that, we will never stop suffering. It will never stop inflicting this pain upon our peoples. This, I think, for a lot of people, not just in Lebanon, but in the region, is the decisive war that must be won and that must end in the collapse of Israel, which, of course, creates a very dangerous situation, including for Israel itself. If people, I've said this repeatedly, Chris, the only thing you care about is Israel. If you're one of those people, you don't care about anything else, you just care about Israel, you should be at the front of the line of people who are demanding that our governments bring this to an end, because this will end by hook or by crook in Israel's destruction.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dmitry Lascaris. Dmitry's a lawyer, activist, and frontline journalist who's been producing intensive on-the-ground reports from West Asia over the last year and created the new podcast, Reason to Resist, in the lead-up to the all-out war we're witnessing there right now. He's just back from Beirut. I'm talking to him today from his home base in Greece. Well, Dmitry, you may not be an expert on Lebanon, but you certainly know people that are. You speak on your show, A Reason to Resist, with our friend Laith Marouf and also Gaddy Francis, a Lebanese journalist. You're talking to a lot of the people that do know what's going on. And so when you say the sentiment there, is united, then I can take it that that the hope of the French, for example, that tried to send envoys over there to develop a relationship with the Lebanese state military to use them as proxies against Hezbollah, when that's a no-go, then we can safely assume that that's not going to happen.
Oh, no, this is a fantasy, Chris. This is just another example of how really incompetent our leaders are, that they think that this can actually be realistically accomplished. First of all, a substantial proportion of the Lebanese soldiers in the Lebanese National Army are sympathetic to Hezbollah. They are serving in the Lebanese Army because they have a legal obligation to do so. The moment that the Lebanese Army turns upon Hezbollah, a lot of them are going to desert and go fight on the side of Hezbollah. The second thing is the Lebanese Army can't disarm Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a more formidable force than the Lebanese army. Thirdly, even if the Lebanese army turned on Hezbollah and managed to inflict substantial pain upon Hezbollah as an organization and diminish its fighting capacity, it still is going to remain a formidable enemy to Israel. And for all the reasons I've articulated about the nature of the terrain and so forth and the geopolitical circumstances in the region, even with the Lebanese army turning against Hezbollah, which I think is an absolute pipe dream, I don't think that they're going to succeed in destroying Hezbollah. They'll just cause a lot more pain to the people of Lebanon. That's ultimately what's going to happen. If the people in our halls of power actually had a functioning, you know, diplomatic brain, and I think we've seen throughout the Ukraine war that there are really no adults in the room when we're talking about foreign policy decision makers in the West. They would know that the only way to prevent the strategic defeat of Israel and stop the bloodshed is to demand that Israel end the killing in Gaza and finally give the Palestinian people a state. That is the reality. Whatever you may think of it, that's the reality. And they refuse to take cognizance of the obvious situation that they confront.
Well, maybe they do realize that, but they want to make sure that what remains is so compromised that it will take generations for people to get on their feet again and ever pose any kind of opposition to Israel in any mm-hmm. form. I mean, we see Gaza is a good example. I'm just looking too, is in Lebanon. You were the last time you and I spoke, I believe you'd just been in the south of Lebanon. You couldn't get there this time because of the situation. I'm looking at the Guardian reports of the killing just a few hours ago of the mayor of Nabatea, and mm-hmm. when the municipal headquarters there, their city hall, as we would have it, was mm-hmm. Blown up, targeted and blown up by missiles.
Oh, they basically, it's not just, the municipal headquarters. They killed a number of municipal officials, but they basically carpet bombed Nabatea today. I've been to Nabatea three times, I think, maybe four times in the course of the past year. And Nabatea is a stronghold of Hezbollah. It has seen many battles and suffered greatly over the years in its resistance to the Israeli occupier. And throughout the city, there is, you know, there are monuments everywhere, mementos and various ways by which the locals remember and, you know, honor the past of resistance. These are very, very tough people. What Israel did today to Nabatea is criminal. There's no reason to believe, because it's what it's gotten away with thus far, that the West will hold it accountable. But if they think that this is going to stop Hezbollah by slaughtering the people of Nabatea, they've learned absolutely nothing from their many battles with the resistance forces in South Lebanon. These people have a very, very high tolerance for pain, much more so than Israeli society. So ultimately, this is not going to succeed. This is, we're watching today, the application of the Dahiya Doctrine to Nabatea. The Dahiya Doctrine is a failure. It's never worked, ever, anywhere.
Well, I wonder, though, if that doctrine, and that is the doctrine of maximum pain to the civilian population to get them to turn against the government, isn't really aimed at people in Beirut and the north part of Lebanon, where they look and they look at what's happening in Gaza, they look at what's happening in the south, and they think, Jesus, we don't want that to come to us. And so that schism that Israel seems to be trying to create within the country is more easily widened.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're not, you know, the people, the majority reaction that I, as far as I can tell, and this is systematically been the case when Israel has tried to win wars by inflicting enormous suffering on civilian populations, is that rather than turn them against the resistance, they end up becoming more emboldened in their hatred of the aggressor and the occupier. That, I think, is the that history has shown that populations subjected to this kind of treatment overwhelmingly have that reaction. They become angry. These become recruitment tools for resistance groups or what they call terrorist organizations. You know, this causes them to elect leaders who are more radical, more aggressive. So show me one instance in which the Dahiya Doctrine, whether it was being implemented by Israel or, you know, some Western government under some other name, because it's not just Israel who does this. The United States has been doing this. The British do this. Where has it worked? Where has this resulted in, a government being overthrown and one being put in its place by the people, not by the U.S., but by the people, who is subservient to Washington? I'm not aware of an example where it has been successfully applied. There's no reason to think that's going to happen here.
Well, and more than 21 years since Shock and Awe was launched against Iraq, there's missiles coming from Iraq yet, missiles hitting Israel and American bases in Syria and other places.
And you have a government there that is far more aligned with Iran than any Iraqi government of our lifetimes.
Well,
so
that's,
look what they accomplished there. I mean, it's exactly the opposite of what they wanted to accomplish.
Well, when I watch some of the more alternative, mainstream alternative media, it's sometimes called, there seems to be great boosterism for the abilities of Iran and Hezbollah to inflict damage. But I don't, they seem not really to be inflicting a lot of direct military damage on Israel, at least. It seems to be a lot of bluster to me. I was amazed in the last two retaliation attacks by Iran. They, in both occasions, warned Israel ahead of time, giving them the time to move F-35 jets, for example, to the bases in Cyprus to get them out of harm's way. What do you think is the viability of that kind of deterrence?
Well, I don't think that they it has been demonstrated that they did give Israel advance warning. I know that that report is circulated, but I saw a statement from the Iranian government that it emphatically denied having given advance warning to Israel. But even if it did, it was much shorter warning than last time. And secondly, I don't think that we know the full extent of the damage that was caused. The Israelis have been very, very adamant about prosecuting anybody who reports damage caused by missile strikes by, you know, these resistance groups or Iran. Why are they doing that? If the damage is minimal, why have they clamped down on any reporting of the damage? Why wouldn't they give, you know, journalists free rein to come and see their military bases intact? That's because they have sustained damage. And there are videos showing that have been verified by the U.S. media, videos showing dozens of ballistic missiles striking Israel's probably most protected military base, and that's the Nevatim Air Base, where the F-35s are situated. The Iranians have demonstrated beyond a shadow of a doubt, and I've spoken to numerous military experts, independent military experts about this, and I've heard many others opine the same thing. They've shown beyond a shadow of doubt that they can strike anything in Israel. There's nothing in Israel that is invulnerable to Iranian missile attack. The only thing that is saving the Israelis at this point is that the Iranians really, really don't want to go to war with the United States. That is why they've shown restraint. But I think we are now, as John Mearsheimer has said, we are clearly on the escalation ladder, and Iran has put Israel on the escalation ladder. And if it attacks Iran in a serious way, you are going to see, I believe, a much more devastating attack on Israel, one that is going to shock the population. It won't necessarily be one that causes Israel's defeat, but it will cause shock both to the Israeli population and to Western governments. And, you know, part of the reason, Chris, why we haven't seen I just, you know, interviewed Ray McGovern, and we talked about this. Where does this all go from now? Go from here? And he said, look, it's been 16 days since Iran attacked. And it did something that no other country has ever done, no other foreign military has ever done to Israel, you know, hitting with missiles major military facilities, despite every effort being made to protect them with multiple air defense systems of multiple countries. And it's possible that they have caused real concern in the military leadership of Israel, and there is a serious and difficult conversation going on in the military and civilian leadership about whether there should be a large-scale attack on Iran, because they're afraid, and they should be afraid. If they're being rational, they would be very afraid about what's going to happen if they attack Iran.
Well, Jeremy Lofredo, the reporter from the Gray Zone, arrested after going down to the Nezatim base and taking pictures, although he was with other media and their pictures and stuff, they were allowed in and were cleared, but he was arrested after the fact. He held.
He didn't just go to Nezatim. I think that was not my guess is that's not what got the Israelis worked up. What got the Israelis worked up is that he went to the Mossad headquarters in Tel Aviv,
right?
And he found a large crater. I think it was like 100 meters, or maybe it was 300 meters. I can't remember the exact distance. And he showed pictures of this. Okay, so that is something that the Israelis don't want the public to know, that the Iranians are capable of destroying the Mossad headquarters. You know, the Mossad. This is, you know, the people, if anything's going to be protected in Israel from an Iranian missile attack, you'd think it would be the Mossad headquarters, and they missed it by a hair. So I think that's what sent them into a frenzy and caused them to do this to Lofredo. But what does that tell you? It tells you that they are mortally fearful of people knowing the truth about Iran's missile capabilities.
Well, and knowing the truth about the warning, because I still want to push back on that, because I read reports after that second attack saying that they had been warned and given hours. Now the Wall Street Journal is saying that they didn't say that, but even Iran says it gave warning before the first attack. U.S. says that's not true, as a Reuters headline from April. I mean, now it's into the Merck zone, and we don't know what to believe.
But let's say for the sake of argument that you're right. Okay, and maybe you are. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know for sure. I mean, no, I don't think anybody knows for sure what happened. But if they did give a warning, what that militates in favor of my argument, which is to say they have the ability to inflict far greater damage to Israel. If they got that many missiles through with these sensitive targets after having given Israel a warning, these are hypersonic missiles that can arrive in Israel in something like 11 minutes. If Israel has no warning at all, they're in a world of pain. So if that is in fact what happened, I think it actually makes the argument that I'm putting forward more compelling.
Well, the fact that Iran killed only one person was killed that was reported, and that was probably from falling debris from the interception missiles, the Iron Dome so-called, says a lot too, that the Iranians didn't want to kill people because they could have done, presumably, if they really wanted to. We're fast out of time. Dimitri, do you want to plug your show and tell people how they can get to see it? It's really going like wildfire. You're getting bigger and better guests all the time, and more information that we're not usually seeing. How do people get in on this and find out what you're finding out?
Well, the program is called Reason to Resist. My YouTube handle is at Dimitri Lascaris 3051. I also post all of my videos on Rumble, and there my handle is at Dimitri Lascaris, DimitriLascaris. And also I'm on X using that same handle at Dimitri Lascaris, and there I direct, you know, people to my videos. So I'm doing basically two types of reporting. One is these interviews that, you know, you mentioned of, you know, people who have dissenting views and expertise that is very important. And the other is on the ground reporting, which I've, you know, been doing from West Asia as much as possible over the past year.
And your legacy site, I guess I can call it now, DimitriLascaris.org, and you can get links to all of the other stuff that Dimitri's talking about. I really appreciate it, Dimitri, you coming on and painting the house, seeing as you're doing so much media already and coming on this little humble show.
Oh, thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, Chris. You're doing great work.